Hi, I'm Marily Luengo, and you're listening to Drinking and Dashing, Torah with a Twist. And in this episode, everything go according to plan until I start talking Spanglish.
Hey everybody, don't worry. It's not just me tonight, or in this episode. I mean, kind of it's me, but don't worry, it's not just me. I mean, there are other people who are going to come on, I promise. So in the numbers, if we're counting the numbers of people who are going to be on this episode, it's not just a one-person episode. There's at least three times that number tonight. And why am I talking about numbers? Well, you'll find out soon enough. But get ready for a new beginning, a new book, and let's get started. So I know that last week when we finished with the Hukotai, I did a really short version and it was a solo show. And I was like, hey, we're so excited to come back for Bamidbar. And guess what? We are so excited to come back and be here for Bamidbar for starting this new book. And in a weird way, it's still a little bit of a solo show because tonight we don't have Gabe, we don't have Idan, but we do have their love from afar. We're really, really rooting for them where they are, whether that's at Havanashir, whether that's working. We're really proud of everything they're doing this week. And don't worry, just because I'm solo hosting doesn't mean that I'm by myself. Instead, I have two incredible Wonder Women with me tonight to talk about the beginnings of a new book that somehow talks about math, which is so confusing because I never signed on for that when I went to rabbinical school. But that's okay. We'll start anyway. We're so excited to welcome Marielle Luengo as our featured guest tonight. A truly multi-ethnic individual, Marielle Luengo grew up in Puerto Rico and Spain, raised by strong and self-reliant Sephardic Jewish women. Marielle focused her efforts early on to campaign for marriage equality and to end the practice of human trafficking that plagues our world. Following graduation, she joined the Goldsmith Family Fund, where her focus was on the development of funds for philanthropic work, including Jewish education, and then developing funds for emerging crisis management. Upon relocating to Cleveland, Marielle continued to work diligently to bring her unique experience, skills, and talents to improve the greater Cleveland area within her area of expertise as a leading nonprofit consultant, eventually opening her own agency, Pueblo Strategy. Drawing on her strengths of strategy development, urban research development, public campaigning, and comprehensive cultural marketing, Marielle has grown her philosophy of equality, justice, and innovation through her work, serving on the boards of multiple Cleveland organizations. She is also co-founder of the West Tribe, a nonprofit that serves and assists the Jewish community on Cleveland's West Side, and a committee member of the Association of Junior Leagues International's Diversity and Inclusion Body. Marielle was the 2020 recipient of the Iron Zemin Volunteer Award for the efforts to fight food insecurity by starting and running the West Tribe Food Co-op, a local nonprofit that aims to take the negative stigma out of utilizing food banks. Recently, woot woot, Marielle joined CNN and Espanol Network as a guest panelist for art and culture in the Latinx community and is a member of the National Association of Journalists and is among the 100 Latinos to know in Cleveland for 2021. Marielle also is active in the Cleveland organization Jews of Color, which is a positive experience that promotes honor of the intersection of both her Jewish and Latinx roots. We're also super stoked to welcome Rabbi Stacey Schlein tonight as our Q&A guest. So welcome Marielle and Stacey to the show. I'm so excited that you're here with me and I'm not all on my own this week.
Hola, Amanda. This is a Cleveland show. We're taking over.
We're so happy to be here with you.
I'm so, so thrilled that you're all here. And for those listening at home, you're going to find out that it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek and a little bit of a pushback against this week's portion because we've decided that we want some incredible voices to stand up this week in a portion that might try to, I don't know, leave us out. But stay tuned because we're getting started now. So what people listening may not realize is when I met Marielle, it was through this app called Clubhouse. And what's really weird about that was everyone was kind of allowed into the Clubhouse. But in this week's portion, we find that maybe not everybody is always invited to the Clubhouse, that only certain people of certain types at certain times might be allowed to enter or be a part of the club. And that's a kind of strange place to start with Bamidbar. But for those people who don't realize, we are in fact beginning a new book. And because I'm no Gabe, but I'm trying my best, I am doing a Parsha rundown, Gabe style, for all of our listeners, and especially tonight for Marielle and for Stacey. Let's go. We're starting off on our fourth book of the Torah in our first Parsha of that book on the first day of the second month in the second year following the Exodus. But who's counting? Well, apparently we are. God has Moses take a census and count all of the males age 20 plus from every tribe, assisted by members of those tribes because, well, let's face it, math is hard. Curious about the numbers? Check out Numbers 120 to 54 for the exact counts, but we max out with Judah at 74,600, with a minimal count at Manasseh for 32,200, and end up with a total count of 603,550 people, which seems like a lot. Wait a minute. Are we missing anyone? Yep, all of the Levites, because they're left out since they're too busy taking care of everything with the tabernacle and can't be bothered with things like being counted. Well, at least that's what God says. We have a camp and battle formation with Asher, Dan, and Naphtali at the north, Issachar, Judah, and Zebulun to the east, Gad, Reuben, and Simeon to the south, and Benjamin, Ephraim, and Manasseh to the west, while the Levites make sure that the tabernacle is flanked on all sides. Well, that's good, at least. The Levites get a promotion once more to take care of Aaron and to serve the Kohanim, acting as the firstborn among all the Israelites. Clearly, our Torah is a Levite fan, am I right? But if that counting weren't enough, now we're counting the Levite men, excuse me, babies and youngins from 1 month old. Yikes, this didn't go so well in Egypt, hopefully it'll be much different now. In case you're curious, there are about 22,000, plus or minus 300. But hey, math is hard. Now, we're counting all of the Israelite male children 1 month up, and that comes to about 22,273, because of course it did. But all of those Levites and Israelites need to be redeemed, and that means money, so we've got to pay up to the priests, right? Maybe. Okay. Finally, for some reason, we have one more count of the Kohathites, who are a subsection of the Levites, but this time, we're aiming for those males between 30 to 50 who can be trusted to help out with the Tent of Meeting. They take care of the tabernacle tasks and objects. Cool. We learn who lights oils and incense. Heads up, it's Eleazar. And Moses and Aaron are tasked with not letting the Kohathites die because they saw the dismantling of the sanctuary. Whoops. And that's what you get with Bamidbar.
Amanda, that was great. That was a math class make interest for once.
Oh, you said math was hard. No problem whatsoever.
It helps when the Torah gives you the exact numbers, but there's a problem when the Torah gets it wrong. Dun, dun, dun.
Does the Torah get it wrong?
Well, technically it says that there are no mistakes in the Torah. There's this idea that there's no mistakes in the Torah, but something doesn't add up.
Maybe we have been told that numbers don't lie, but maybe that is not completely true. Maybe the manipulation of numbers and the projection of data have always been used for advantage. And maybe we hide behind fancy numbers to tell a full story.
You know, we have been told in the past that data helps us tell a story, but I wonder what our stories tell us about the data that we may not recognize. I'm really looking forward to finding that out as we continue our conversation next. Marielle, I am so thrilled to actually be here with you in person on Zoom, but not just on Clubhouse on the phone, but like really get to see your smile as you talk and see all of the work that you've been doing and how incredible it is. And you've been all over the place in Cleveland in terms of working with health organizations, working with Jewish organizations, really trying to ensure that Cleveland is up and coming and making sure that everybody is served. And I want to know what drives that work. I know you talked about growing up with incredibly strong and self-reliant Jewish women, but for you, what drives the work that you're doing now and those, you know, just incredible successes that you've been reaching, especially in Cleveland?
Amanda, that's so kind of you. And I'm also so surprised that you're willing to admit to the public that we met in Clubhouse. I thought that was going to be your little secret. But that's okay. I will go there with you. I will own to my own mistakes and just put it in the pandemic decisions years. I'm so thankful that our friendship came out of there. I, in the end of the day, have to go to sleep with myself. And I do take a census, which we will use that word a lot today, in the end of the day. And I don't know. I think we all do it. I just think maybe I'm slightly more neurotic about it. So I do have a speed internally that make me want to do things. But I get heartbroken by injustice all the time, and I really want to fix it. And I feel the power of numbers and math and data help me to do so. So very attached to this Torah portion.
I really appreciate that. As I was reading and preparing for the Parsha Rundown, and this is something that Gabe does a lot more than I do, and so I will admit openly, yes, Gabe, rabbis, or at least rabbinical students, do read. I went through and I was looking at all these things, and I couldn't help but notice that the data was telling a story, but it wasn't telling my story. And I was really struggling with that a little bit because it kept talking about it counted men 20 plus. Well, I got you. I'm 20 plus, right? Like, I definitely hit that demographic, but I'm not a man. And it talked about counting, you know, children 1 month plus. And I got you. I'm 1 month plus for sure. I know that. But I didn't see me in the story. And then even as it continued moving into the Israelites, moving into the Kohatites, even when we got to 30 to 50, hey, I'm here. I'm 30 plus, you know, but I'm not in the story. And so what does that mean when we begin a book and we've made our way all through the first chapter of a whole book, like the first parsha of a whole new book, and I don't see myself in the data?
Let me twist that around. How many times you as a rabbi have to send boring, boring, boring emails to people? And how many times we have to chase down to people to reply yes or no to an appointment, right? It's something really humbling about the boring, tedious task of leadership. When you think about this portion of Torah, where Moses himself have to go canvassing to get these numbers right. I see a lot of holiness in doing the unsexy part of leadership. And I see myself there all the time. I think overall, Judaism don't have anything cool to say about leaders. In fact, it's highly questionable all the time. And I think this is one of those examples of like, well, you want to be in charge? You have to do the boring things, including counting and collecting. And I really like this tragedy behind it, right? It was many methods and ways to try to make it kind of equal or weird in a weird way that was not equal at all. But it was some kind of a strategy to try to make it fair. And I want to believe that now we know so much better and we can do so much better.
It's really interesting. I just recently did a Torah study course in Bihar. And in Bihar, we talk about this idea of liberty for all. And in Bihar, like, we realize that, like, well, wait a minute, not everybody is equal. It's not really liberty for all. It's liberty for some. And those people are generally the people who are in our circle, right? The people who are like us. And I'm curious about this idea. I love that you talked to this point of kind of the unfun or the unsexy part of leadership. And I'm curious what we might be missing when we use our perspectives to only count the people that look like us or seem like us or act like us. Who might we be missing out on?
So I'm very interested about the dynamics before and the after of the counting. I really want to ask, who is doing the counting and for what? Right? We have enough evidence that now we know scientifically in our community and many other communities, the researchers that also do the questioning, depending their race, we will have more equal results. That is proven. And I also wonder the kind of authority and the kind of culture that you have to be able to be trustworthy with the information. If you're a stranger in your own community and you come around and you start asking for numbers and data, you're not going to get it. Which is why Hispanic people, as the communities that I serve, don't participate in the census. And we have highly inaccurate numbers of it because it's nothing to trust you with it. I want to switch the dynamic of who is asking these questions and what kind of tales we're telling and what kind of data we're collecting for what purpose. Normally, and Amanda, this is the dirty secret of nonprofit. Normally we collect data in answers that we want the questions, not the other way around it, right? We want an answer and we build a question around it and we get the pretty numbers so we can impress the founders with it. It's rarely the other way around it. So even what we're asking, who is asking and who to asking, it's a whole dynamic of power that I can weigh that is all flip around. I work a lot with Jews of Color. My community is majority Jews of Color. That's the deep intimacy. And when I go to other Jewish spaces, it's always like, but where are the rest? And I'm like, they don't trust you and they're not going to come, right? The dynamic also with the Jews of Color is recently we were determined to be 15 to 20% of the Jewish population in the United States. And then one fancy, not so nice man went and challenged that idea with not that much data behind it. So the challenge to be, go beyond the numerics is about the values that we want to hold each other accountable for.
That reminds me a little bit. I just recently saw a cartoon where there was a PowerPoint being shown, and it was people who love taking surveys, people who throw them in the trash, and it was 98% people who love taking surveys, 2% people who like throw them in the trash. You know, that speaks to this idea of we sometimes create our own reality, and sometimes we create our realities or create answers or questions that will help reflect that reality back to us or what we are hoping to see. And I wondered if maybe the reason that Moses had these assistants was to maybe get rid of that confirmation bias, you know, maybe was this idea of somebody who was willing to actually keep us honest about the numbers. And it makes me think again, you know, this was an interesting situation because it seems like they're gearing up for battle. Right? Like, we're talking about arms bearing people, we're talking about troops, we're talking about numbers, and this would not be their first battle. The Israelite community has had quite a few battles. But I wonder when it comes down to it, right? Like, when we're looking at what's worth fighting for, who do we know who to bring into the fight with us? And how do we know that those are the right people?
Amanda, I struggle with this all the time. I also struggle with the idea that once, I think sometimes, purposely, institutionally, we have not count each other. Because once you count each other, you're responsible for it. You can no longer deny it. And those of those realities that come with the counting, it make you assume that responsibility that sometimes we're not prepared for institutionally wise. So yeah, I think purposely sometimes we just don't want to know where the other ones stand. And I also wonder, again, what make a good, strong community that once you have to do these countings, and normally they don't happen in pretty times, right? If it's pretty calm times, you have many methods to do it. Normally, the more chaotic that is timing is, the more counting you have to do. We see in the rest of the Torah that during the 40 years that our people were in the desert, every time that they have a pandemic happening, they have to do a census again. So what is that we can build with each other? What trust, what culture, what common experiences, what worship we can build with each other that when we literally have to count each other, we can do it in a way that fairness and consent. I have two rabbis here, so they're better off answering that question than I am.
You know, I can honestly say that this parsha gave me some pause because not only are we thinking about this idea of consent and ability, but we're also talking about worth, you know, what people's lives are worth and who people's lives are worth. We're told in here that the Levites are like the creme de la creme, like they're akin to the firstborn, and the Israelites and the Levites like need to be redeemed for each other. And that's such an interesting thing. Like, who's worth more in these situations? I think if you're gearing up, and what I've noticed about the Jewish community often is when, I think you're right, Maria, I think when things are bad, the Jewish community comes together and like unites in a really strong way often. And I think that as soon as things let up being bad, often it goes back to those like divisions that we had pre-bad thing, like pre-pandemic or pre-anti-Semitism or pre like major disaster. And I think one of the things that I'm so curious about is if we're trying to build this community, this like beautiful, holy community, right? If this Torah is supposed to be our instruction for how to build what I would argue is a holy community in a realistic world, how is it that we're still managing to make it so unequal?
Amanda, I wish I have a simple answer for you. I really do. I have a lot of suspicions about why. But I don't have a simple answer. What I know is the lack of tracing and the lack of data helps justify a lot of hate. Good data, good numbers, good accountability is such a powerful tool against us who are doing the work to more equitable work. And that have not always been simple. Like I say early on, data can be so easy to manipulate and numbers can be so easy to switch, right? Recently, we have something, somebody saying in a very fancy board meeting, well, it's only 1% of the budget. Just to figure out that 1% was like 70 million, right? Extraordinarily dismissing things to say. I just think when we bring it back to the one-on-one, reminding ourselves in our daily building the power of one, the power of the humanity, the persona behind the number, how many opportunities during the day, how many applications we're going to have to remind humanity? Are we going to do that through the arts? Are we going to do that through exposure? Are we going to do that with our storytelling? Data and storytelling have to come together because otherwise it's incomplete truth. Don't you hate it when somebody start talking from their heart and you're like, but give me the numbers. What does this mean? Or don't you hate it when that counting person come in and you're like, but how many people actually get impact for this? The true leaders now have to combine these both two powerful things and make credibility, because that's the end of the day, the only thing that is going to make us move forward. I may have the better ideas, you may have the better data, but if I don't build any trust with you, we're not walking forward.
I think that's true. I think that that was a lot of the time when people talk about this idea that Moses had the vision, but Aaron had the people, that was a big teamwork situation. And I know that what you're saying aligns deeply with the work. And it seems like this Torah portion has really like inspired you in some ways of what to do and what not to do. And so I'm curious, what insights do you glean from this particular portion? How does it impact kind of what you feel about the work that you're doing now?
It makes me be very sneaky about how I collect data. I live in a community that historically have been underrepresented. I have been a community that normally have been undervalued in many ways, numerically speaking and importance speaking. So I do understand the importance to keep track of my own community so I can go to these fancy board meetings and drop these numbers. But I don't want to do it at the expense of the dignity of the people that I'm serving. So that have made me very sneaky about how I collect this data. I don't collect data from people that I don't have full consent. I don't collect data from people that have not had a full cup of coffee with them before. And I don't collect data with people who are not in it with me. They know why I'm collecting this information. They know where they need to be accountable for it. And we keep a full transparency of the power of collecting these numbers and the man to do it. And it takes so much time, and it takes so much money, and it takes so much more effort to do it that way. I don't want to live in a community that treat me like a number, and I refuse to do it the same in the past. And I'm always asking who I'm not counting, right? I think a lot of what our work allows to do is to believe that we're the good people, that somehow or another, because of our intentions and of our heart, and because we go to all these fancy trainings, we will get it right, when in fact, we're pretty much part of the problem. And we have to hold this accountability over our privilege, right? What is through my privilege and through my biases that I'm not counting? And we see this in every aspect. I also belong to the Hispanic community, where getting counted literally can get you killed. Where getting counted means that sometimes you will be separated from your children miles and miles and countries away, right? Where getting counted is a very defiant, risky, expensive task for a lot of our families. And it's all these mechanisms to have a life to prevent to be counted in every step. And by definition, we have this super majority of a country that we don't have a good number on it, that is underserved, that come with all this trauma of immigration. And then I live in this Jewish community where we're very fortunate that that's not our case. But then historically, we have put aside the definitions of what is a Jew and what is a Jew that matter and all of these things. So it always goes back to building relationships and who move yourself away from the center. I know there's no numbers that I'm not going to get because who I am. and somebody in a different position with better representation and with better identification in that community will be way more qualified for me to get a number. And it always goes back to like, who is doing the asking, who is collecting the data, and for what? I go back to thinking that, you know, yeah, the Levites, they have it better, but they also could not own any land. So do that was a way of the Torah to try to even this out? Probably not. Probably some fancy scholars will say that that was a way to free them for the common duties. But it was actually the only social mobility that they have. I find something really trapping about the Levites being counted that way. They do not have many options about their own destiny. Again, if Moses can go door to door, you know, we also can do those boring stories. I also do the door to door. We also can take those coffees with our community. We can spend the time.
I really appreciate all of that, especially when we're talking about this idea of the camp and each person has their place. And, you know, the Levites are surrounding the tabernacle. But I have to tell you, and I don't know about anybody else that grew up going to religious school, but hi, I grew up going to religious school. And here's what I learned in religious school. So our religious school teachers, I really appreciate and respect you. Heads up, just like, it's not an insult, I promise. But here's what I grew up learning. I grew up learning that there were three types of Jews in ancient Israel, right? I grew up learning about the Kohanim, the priests. I grew up learning about the Levites. And I grew up learning about the Israelites. In this portion, there's four types of Levites. Like, it's not just, like, Levites, right? It maybe Levite is an umbrella term, but, like, there's so much more within that umbrella term that, like, we just don't learn about in school, or I did not learn about in school. Sorry, maybe some awesome religious school teachers are teaching about this in school, but I don't think most are, and I don't think most Jews would ever know that under this Levite statement, like, there are four groups that were different and taking care of things, and it had each of them a different expectation or a different quality. And I think one of the things I get nervous about counting, I know you said, Marielle, that, like, sometimes being counted can get you killed. I worry sometimes that when we miss the mark and we don't look for, you know, the beautiful, incredible dimensions to these umbrella communities, that, like, we might miss out a lot more than counting.
So much more. Look, my grandparents were these people, right? My grandparents were the typical Sephardim, who their big accomplishments was going to completely integrate their kids and grandkids into society and make them forget their Jews, which they deeply fail with me, right? I'm the disappointment of my family for being a Jew in public. But the whole thing was not to get counted. And yes, when you count my grandparents in the large history of Judaism, they tell a story of resistance that is rare. They tell a story of preservation that is deep. They tell a story of Jewish diversity that often get lost, right? My grandparents' whole family fit like in two Jewish books. They're often told, once you're a doctor in Judaism, you learn about the specifics of my family. And more important, when the State of Israel was founded, they do not count my grandparents initially, which was heartbroken for them. Deeply heartbroken for them. And it was many years later and many paperwork later that they did. But imagine going country to country, then going to the tropics, jumping from one island to the other, getting a homeland, and that homeland don't recognize you immediately. Which also happened to many other Jews, like Ethiopian Jews, right? Ethiopian Jews spent 10 decades proving their Judaism and attachment. It must be so deeply heartbroken to take that long to get counted. I refuse. Any amount of power that we'll have will prevent that.
I'm really inspired by your answers today, and I could keep asking questions forever because Gabe's not here to stop me, but I know he would say that I have to give someone else a chance. And so I've got our famous last question to ask you before I move on to our incredible Q&A section. And so, Marielle, if you had just one message that you wanted to share with our listeners, what would your call to action be? What would you hope they might know or do or feel after hearing this episode?
I hope that they start questioning who's doing the counting and for what. You want to know where the Jews of color are? All the Jews of color. You want to know how many are? Let us ourselves count each other. We will get the right number. You want to know how many queer, transgender Jews you have in your group? Ask them directly. Build enough trust that they will come forward for the numbers that you need. And ask yourself if you should be the one keeping the list, because probably not.
One of the best parts about my life has been the ability to constantly come into contact with people who teach me and who I would argue are smarter than I am. And in this particular episode, I've got two of those people. I have Marielle and I have Rabbi Stacy Schlein, both who support me in everything that I'm doing, and some of whom actually sit in a panel that I'm teaching on and make sure to give me good feedback so that I can be even better the next time I get invited to come to a panel. Thank you, ARJE, for having me for that one. Rabbi Stacy Schlein, I'm so excited that you're here. I'm going to read your bio, and then I'm going to pass you the mic so that you can take over my show because you're going to, you know, make it even better. Rabbi Stacy L. Schlein is Director of Educational Capacity Building at Cleveland's Jewish Education Center, where she supports synagogue and early childhood programs. She was a rabbi and educator at the Temple Tiferet Israel in Cleveland for 14 years, which is strange because she's only 28. Rabbi Schlein was ordained at HUCJR in New York in 2001 and earned the school's executive MA in Jewish education, and in my life greatly influenced me when she got to work beside me and teach me and my students at the URJ Kutz Camp, RIP. Rabbi Stacy Schlein, I'm so happy to truly pass you the mic, and Marielle, Stacy, please enjoy your conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here, and I have to say it was such an honor when you reached out to me, because I have such strong, powerful memories of that experience of being together at Kutz, watching you do your magic, so excited, thinking about everything you'd be able to undertake in your studies, and even better than I imagined it would be. And also, I only met Marielle, I think this past year. We had not met before. And there was something so special knowing that the two of you were somehow connected, even if it was Clubhouse, it's okay. Because there's such a passion and an energy for both of you in the work that you do. And yes, this episode is brought to you by Clubhouse. Thank you very much. One of the things, Marielle, when you were talking, I kept getting chills when you were talking about ways that you have counted or haven't. And there's something in how you describe it where I would think in some cases, I could very easily see someone making that statement and being so heartbroken, devastated, that it would make them completely stop diving in or just quitting. And when you talk, even when you talk about the frustrations or label them or quantify or count them, there's this energy behind it in your voice. And where does that come from?
I don't know. But I am somebody who I'm very numerically in my head, which is why this parsha is one of my favorites. If you see inside my brain, it's like a Tetris game. But I also keep a clock and I know how short we have it here. So I really try to do legacy work. I am so privileged. I have so much. It has to be about when we're not around. It has to be things that I can quantify that will be there when I'm not around. But I don't know. I just really, really want to lay down at night and think to myself that I did the best. I will still take an Ambien, but at least I want to try to go to sleep.
Okay, well, that makes me feel a little better, at least. With all of the different things that you do, and particularly the different ways you participate here in Cleveland, it really does not seem like you actually sleep, because there's so many different levels, and that's how it appears. But you were describing that in early on, talking about how you do that counting or the accounting of it when you lay down at night. How do you weigh the things that you accomplish versus the things that are still on the list that you wanted to accomplish?
Well, I actually do a lot of math for that, because I really like the math for parameters, how much I have been given and how I can turn that into much more. I have been extraordinarily privileged. Girls who were born where I was born normally don't make it out, right? It was so many times for my family to be interrupted for not maybe here. And then, you know, you and I experienced the same city, which is a city full of big despairs and also big amount of abundance. We have it here better than most places. Our Jewish community have it better than most Jewish communities. So how not to do everything? And I'm also really bored of what we have. And that's the truth. Why not? I have absolutely nothing to lose. So let's try to go for the radical. Let's try to go for what we all wanted. I truthfully believe most of us in the end of the day really want very similar things.
You referenced a little bit about the Cleveland Jewish community, and I'm really glad that you're as biased as I am in terms of how many wonderful resources and incredible things we have. And also, you really spend a lot of time to make sure that we are able to do more. I'd love for you to share a little bit about the West Tribe. I think people would be really interested to hear about that.
Oh, I don't know. I think Amanda's going to put us in timeout if we start talking about Cleveland.
She loves Cleveland!
So Cleveland is one of the most segregated cities historically of the country. And one of the segregations that happened is west and east of the river. Historically, Jews always have lived east side of the river. And when I moved to Cleveland, I ended up in the west side of Cleveland. And I do not understand this because it's really 20 minutes difference. It's not even a toll to pay. But it was this big division. And what we learned is that the west side Jews of Cleveland were like this capsule of what the future of Judaism looked like. Our rates of interfaith are really high, are in the 90s. Our rates of Jews of color are higher than other parts of the country. And also, was people who say, true life is not for me. I don't need to belong to a congregation to be a Jew. In fact, please keep the congregation away from me. But please also give me a Jewish community. So I had trying to be answered this question of what Jewish living outside a synagogue look like, which is ironically very similar to a kibbutz life. So we tried to refer to the West Side as one large kibbutz where we tried these things. And when emergency happened, like COVID, we were able to put a food pantry together really quickly and do it our way. We take a lot of pride in knowing each other deeply. It's not privacy here. You lost that right when you moved to the West Side as a Jew. We also take a lot of pride in thinking that we're raising each other's children. So that is a big, big part of this thing. I like to feel that we're like experimenting with the future of Judaism and where is it going. And in the end of the day, even Jews who call themselves bad Jews, which is not such a thing, or barely Jew, which is also not a thing, in the end of the day, it's a huge sense of relief when we can count each other. When we find each other, when that moment happened, normally it's a spark. Normally it's a huge sense of relief.
I really appreciated throughout in multiple ways when you were talking about that relationship between the data and the stories and having open-ended or being open to what the story could be versus having a closed ending and trying to guide numbers towards what we think it might be, that key piece of trust and constantly asking, who have we missed? Who have we not been counting? How can we get that information? When I hear you say, what we need to do is build the trust, and you describe what you do in developing the relationships, like you said, it's a lot of hard work, a lot of time, a lot of coffee. But I still have the sense that as you're describing it, there's more. It's more than just that time. It's more than the shared experiences. Would you agree or no?
I don't know. I imagine it's more. I imagine our ancestors are guiding us to each other. I imagine our core traditions and values are running deep in each other, even when we don't talk about it. I imagine Torah have us all wrap around with a lot of instructions, directly and indirectly. I know all that to be true. But I always try to tell people, like, building community is a very selfish act. You're better off if you have a good community. It's not as selfless as we want to sell it. You're better off, your family's better off, if you build a strong community. I want to also start when we talk about counting and measurements, I want to start asking different questions too. Instead of having the data about the previous questions, I want to have new data and new numbers. I really want to know how many transgender Jewish women need access to the mikvah. That's a question that we have not asked. We have not have the infrastructure to ask, but that's a number that I would love to have. I want to know how many Jewish teens are struggling with mental health and the specifics of that. I want to know how safe Jews of color feel in synagogues and how we can quantify what they define as safe or not. So I am here for different questions, different data, different people coming to the table. And this is going to happen. I always tell people, your grandkids are going to look like me, and hopefully if they have better schools, they will sound better than me. But your grandkids are very likely to look like me. So gather the data, gather the storytelling, and do it right. And again, it's Cleveland. We have everything here, and we have it twice. There are some numbers that are really painful for me to swallow. For example, for Jewish kids in summer camp, our average budget is over $2,000 that we can spend in scholarships. For Hispanic kids who live 20 minutes away from these Jewish kids in the same city, I have less than 200 for the whole summer. So those data, those numbers are the ones that I'm going to sleep with it to see how we can even them out.
It's amazing. It's a great example to end on. And I really want to say how grateful I am for all of the work that you're doing, not just in Cleveland, but really nationally, hearing your voice and your passion and your energy, particularly when you were talking about how there's something that runs between us, whether it's that shared tradition of Torah or our ancestors, just being open to feeling that connection to others. And in a sense, counting that and seeing that in other people is really extraordinary. So I hope that's what people will take away after hearing this session and your Parsha interpretation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, folks, because this Parsha kicks us off in the book of Numbers, I have to admit it, I looked up some math-based cocktails, and wouldn't you know it, they exist. Apparently, there's a neat way of creating a cocktail through the Fibonacci sequence. You know, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, with each following number totaling the sum of the preceding two. Well, with June on its way, and because of our incredible Parsha, I present to you the Fibonacci Fighter, a delightful daiquiri drink for this week's Midrashic Mixology. In keeping with the Fibonacci sequence, we've created the drink in the same way. Here's what you'll need. 1/4 ounce or 1.5 teaspoons of sugar, 1/4 ounce sugar syrup, 1/2 ounce of triple sec, 3/4 ounces of white rum, and 1 1/4 ounce lemon juice, and as a throw-on, 1 lemon wedge. I get it, it doesn't add up, okay. But 1/4 plus 1/4 plus 1/2 plus 3/4 plus 1 1/4, that's the 1, 1, 2, 3, 5. The math adds up. But here's how you make the drink. Wipe the rim of a chilled cocktail glass with 1 lemon wedge and then dip the end of the glass into your sugar in order to rim your glass. We're going to want to make something sweet out of this a little bit, you know, spicy portion. Then add all of your liquid ingredients one at a time and in order. Make sure that you did a consensus or a census, one or the other, into a cocktail shaker with ice. Shake well and strain the drink into the cocktail glass so that everything's kind of in order. Garnish with your lemon wedge if you like. For a non-alcoholic version, replace the triple sec and white rum with white grape juice. We hope that the flavors of this drink add up to refresh you and get you ready to fight and be counted among the Israelite people. But feel free to charge people 5 shekels per drink or just serve the drinks directly to the priests. L'chaim.
L'chaim.
I think women's drink free. If we don't have to be counted, the drink should be free for us.
Exactly. Free drinks. Beautiful.
Free drinks. I have to give her the credit of saying this, but Rabbi Schlein wrote, "Math is hard. Is the drink too?" And the answer is yes. Not hard to make, though. But yeah.
Okay, good.
I'm glad. I thought actually daiquiris were like kind of a fun way to kick off like spring and give you like a little bit of that, you know, liquid courage if you're going to have some alcohol in it. And if you're not going to have alcohol in it, liquid courage because you're going to be refreshed and like hydrated, you know, for fighting, hydrate or dihydrate.
Wow, Amanda, this is what happens when you don't have your co-host, you know, you go deep in mat with alcohol.
But also really good. I appreciate the hydration because in addition to the numbers, we are in the middle of the desert. We're going to be here a while, so.
And that's how you know she's your rabbi. She's coming to rescue you with an argument, Torah base.
And on that note, Gabe, please come back for the next episode. Thanks. All right, Marielle, I get it. Maybe I'm not as good at Gabe as creating drinks, but I did my best. And like, look, the sum is greater than, you know, I don't know. Math quotes are also difficult for me, but we all know that it's better when Gabe's here. However, because he's not here, I still get to introduce this last section. And unfortunately, we've hit our thank yous and closing cues. And so Marielle, Stacy, while in Bamid Bar, we delve into the numbers, but how do we make sure that we don't lose sight of who counts when we're in the chaos of the wilderness, right? When everything's coming at us. Marielle, we'll start with you.
Put a name and a face to that number. Don't let them just be numbers laying down. Know exactly who you're counting and what you're counting for. And remember, it's humanity behind all that data. It's still us.
Absolutely. Rabbi Stacy Schlein.
There's a interesting thing that I'll do when I get to a portion like this one, where you start having these like lists and the numbers and that, is that I will, for many, many years, I would just and like flip through, not read this. I'll go to another part of the Torah. It's fine. And now I hold myself in the numbers, in the names, very similarly to make sure that I don't lose sight of who is being included, their story. And I think a piece I would take away, really, Marielle, how you said so beautifully, to make sure to constantly be asking and who isn't being counted and who isn't here.
Absolutely. And I know for me, for those that are keeping track at home, I just started my new unit of CPE, that's clinical pastoral education. And I'm seeing patients in a hospital who also often are not seen, but are counted, right? They're often data and they lose their dignity. And one of the things that I want to point out is you don't need to be in a hospital to have somebody kind of try to strip your dignity away, because when they don't identify you and they don't see you for who you are, as Marielle said, when you lose the face and you're just a number, you know, that degrades the people that we're trying to build relationships with. That degrades our community as a whole, right? We talked about this a little bit with the Levites. Sure, Judaism might be this umbrella community, but it's when we look at ourselves as these unique, incredible individuals that make up that community, and we really get to learn everybody's story, that we really get the real data that we need in order to move forward. And it builds out differently than we may have ever expected it to. I know this is a difficult conversation, maybe a different type of conversation. For those that might be interested in following or, you know, continuing the conversation, Marielle, Stacy, how might they be able to find or follow you? Marielle, where can they find you or reach out to you?
I am very good at Instagram, at Marielle Lengo. I normally post when I'm on Ambien and trying to go to sleep, so you will get a very raw insight of my senses daily.
Rabbi Stacy Schlein, where can people find or follow you?
People can find and follow me on Facebook. And also, I would love for you to check out the amazing things that we're doing at the Jewish Education Center of Cleveland. I'd love for you to see our work. So you can find me on our website or our Facebook page too.
Incredible. And we'll make sure to put in some links in the show notes, because we think that people should check out these incredible organizations that Marielle and Stacy are working for, including West Tribe, right? We've talked a lot about West Tribe tonight, so check out those show notes to see what people are interested in doing. Marielle, Stacy, I'm so happy that I got to be with these Wonder Women tonight, that we got to do such a fun, different type of episode for numbers, and that we got to make an episode that, for me, like, really counted and helped uplift a different type of story with a different look at the data. And that's okay. And I would be remiss if I said, I can't not end the episode by saying thank you to Gabe for always doing the rundown and drink. It's actually really hard. I appreciate you. Thank you to Edan, who always does the tech work. It's really hard to do it without you. I tried my best. Hopefully I lived up to your expectations, or at least I certainly lived down to them. And thank you to Kate for always making us sound so brilliant. For our listeners, we're so appreciative of all of you. Keep on listening for the conclusion next, coming at you soon. So I'll tell you, it's a little interesting to try to reflect on an outro by yourself. Normally, I have Gabe and Edan to talk my thoughts out with, and tonight, I'm just sitting here thinking about the fact that I just got to learn with two incredible people, two incredible women, who were able to help me see that sometimes it's not the most important thing to put ourselves in the middle of the story, but to try to figure out what the story is telling us. Generally, I'm a data-driven person. I love metrics. I check our anchor metrics all the time. I like to see who's listening in from where. I try to figure out how we're going to get South Dakota and Wyoming. We haven't gotten there yet, but I think about it all the time. And I think about who the people might be that are listening in and what they might be doing. Are they driving? Are they doing dishes? Are they cooking? Are they preparing for their own tourist study? You know, these are some stories that our data tells me that I then in turn make up. But I'm curious about how our stories impact the data that we get or the data that we create and what that means in terms of how we're building out our Jewish community. It's difficult when people aren't counted. And it's difficult sometimes even when people are counted, especially if counting those people, as Marielle talked about, could put them in danger or even get them killed. Generally, I love the idea of people reaching out to their communities and their friends and having themselves ask the questions and themselves tell the stories. I mean, that's what we're trying to do on this podcast every week. And sometimes I'm sure we miss the mark, but I hope you know that we're always looking for interesting guests on the show. And if you're interested in coming on, please do reach out to us. We'd love to hear your story. We'd love to know about what you're doing Jewish looks like. One of the best ways to do that is to go to our website, www.drinkinganddrashing.com, and use the Contact Us button, or to shoot us an email, drinkinganddrashing@gmail.com, or, you know, send us a message on Instagram or on Facebook to our page. We try really hard to respond as quickly as we can. We hope that you're doing really well, and during this time in the Omer, we hope that you're thinking about what counts and who counts and making sure that you count yourself in. Because we're counting on you. We're really so, so thrilled that you've chosen to spend this time with us and listen in. Know that we're listening out for all of you, and we can't wait to continue collaborating on all of our stories as a community. Be well, stay healthy, L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Stacy Schlein, and you are listening to Drinking and Drashing, Torah with a Twist and with Wonder Women.